Part 5. When I look in my window, backstage in the theater of retail, the pleasure seeker will naturally be pushed towards acquiring greater and greater control over all that surrounds him. Such control is not merely a question of ensuring that others submit to his will, but it is more a matter of possessing complete power over all sources of sensations so that the continuous adjustments can be made which ensure prolonged pleasure. There will, however, be an irreducible element of frustration for even the most powerful of individuals. Colin Campbell. The route that brought me to Kevin Kelly is a little tricky to explain, so bear with me. Suffice to say, at a certain point in my quest to understand the grocery industry, I became so turned around, so confused by the multiple layers of motivation and complicity, by the good people working hard and the hardness that came from it, that I needed to stop worrying about everyone else and just get someone to explain my role in it all as a consumer to me. And that someone was Kevin. But first, our introduction. This was back at the Fancy Food Show in 2015, the very same one where I met Julie, although I hadn't quite met her yet. I was trawling the show, popping samples, collecting totes, and generally marveling at everyone selling their newer, rawer chocolates of ever more singular origin. Somewhere, amid the chaos, I retreated into one of those educational seminars. It was there I happened upon Kevin. When I first see him, he's on stage, backlit by a giant projection screen. Kevin is prowling along the apron, mic in hand, cord trailing behind him, almost like a TV minister before his flock. As he speaks, he is clicking through slides of supermarket floor plans. The room is dead silent staring at these floor plans. But unlike the other educational seminars I attend, it's packed in here, standing room only, and the audience is locked in, glued to Kevin and his architectural diagrams. And so I decide to stay a while, lean against the back wall, unwrap some caramels I've swiped. As my eyes adjust to the room, I notice a series of giant foam boards lining the aisle with Kevin Kelly's face smiling out. Across the top, retail bliss, understanding the mechanics of shopping behavior. The first thing I hear him say, "We are here to facilitate the consumer and create joy." Kevin says this and everything else in a low southern growl. It's a difficult register to convey, both conversational and commanding, with a warm, fuzzy sort of authority that involves a lot of imperatives in the first person plural. It is not too far from the voice of a good guided meditation, booming and soothing, and located as much inside you as apart. "We're not trying to manipulate anyone," Kevin explains from the stage. "To get someone to do something they don't want to do, that's hard. Maybe impossible. Maybe not. But if you did it, would you like yourself?" The room ponders this question. I chew my caramels. "What we want to do is make lives better," he continues. "We want to give energy. And if you do that, do you think your customer will come back? We want to understand the subconscious aspects of how space triggers behavior. And then we want to use those triggers to create joy." The room doesn't need to ponder this. Kevin keeps going. "We want to create physical bliss points, sensory cues that switch you into a certain kind of joy, a sensory environment that activates you." At this, I catch something moving through the room, perhaps the very energy Kevin is talking about. All those silent heads are nodding along in unison. "How do you make your customers feel like a hero?" He pauses to let the question hang, and then it catches me, like a human ripple in the auditorium's pool. Even though I still don't quite know what we're talking about, my neck is nodding too. "How do you make your customer a hero?" Kevin intones again, and suddenly I see it, a hero in every store, a quest, shopping as Mario charging toward the right, scavenging gold coins from the landscape in a hero's journey, left alone to fight the big boss of the register at the end. "Activated," Kevin Kelly booms, "a sensory environment that activates you, where you come in with an empty battery and leave with a full one." I'm rocking back and forth in my pew now, too. Flipping through my press packet of brochures, I find Kevin. He's an architect by training, but one who specializes not in constructing buildings, but in crafting the retail floor. His practice promises a sort of marriage between psychology and architecture, combining ethnographic research on human behavior with interior design to create spaces that fuel sales. Kevin starts talking about a project he worked on for Harley Davidson. "Let them imagine how their life will be better. Let the customer crank up the bike. Every piece on the sales floor is deliberate. We use plywood because we must. We need a warehouse, not a showroom. Who would buy a Harley in a showroom? Not someone in this tribe. Not someone who would ever buy a Harley at all. So we make a space fit for a Harley man. And to do that, we must listen to the Harley man. Remember, we're not trying to manipulate anyone. We are listening to people. All across America, I see checked out shoppers. I see men and women wasting their lives. And at this, he clicks through a mountain of slides of dour men sitting in drabby little shopping malls, plonked down and depressed in chairs as their wives and daughters presumably frolic in an off-screen dressing rooms. Why are these men sitting like that? What type of prison is this? Look at their eyes. It's inhuman. Walking out, when it's all over, I see Kevin Kelly's smooth face on one more foam board and think, huh, that was intense and weird and somewhere between really moving and deeply cynical. I should probably get in touch with that guy. But at that point, I was deluded and thought all that was distraction. I had come to the fancy food show in search of something far more serious. I say serious with a smirk now, but back then I believed it absolutely. I wanted to understand the ethical dimensions of our food, where the claims on our packages came from, who validated them, and what it really meant when something was declared organic, fair trade, rainforest friendly, or gluten-free. This felt deeply important in a way that Kevin Kelly did not. Let me try to explain. For years, whenever given the choice, I just tossed the organic fair trade version into the cart. I had read my Michael Pollan and Eric Schlosser, kept up on my New York Times exposés. I knew the cost of industrial food. Paying extra to make the world a slightly better place seemed like the actual, literal least I could do as a white American male atop the food chain in a financial, social, and caloric sense. It was an opportunity, a sign of my larger sentience and connection to the world. And so without even thinking, I ponied up. Every time. Ethics was habit. But the habit always nagged at me. I had watched organics and fair trade explode into billion-dollar industries. But it was hard to say the world was becoming a better place for the marginal spending. In fact, it felt like it was becoming a more insulated one. I kept thinking of the medieval practice of simony, where the wealthy could pay money to be released from their sins. The grocery store felt like it was becoming a smug secular update, the seals and certifications acting like some sort of moral shield, allowing those of us with disposable income to pay extra for our salvation, and forcing everyone else to deal with the fact that on top of being poor, they were tacitly agreeing to harm the earth, pollute their children via their lunchboxes, and exploit their fellow man each time they made a purchase. And so to better understand, I decided to drill down into the world of ethical labeling. What I quickly learned was that ethics were big business. Those certifications had booths right next to the hot sauce purveyors at conferences like the Fancy Food Show. In the same way a buyer for Safeway might stroll up and down the aisles looking for the next snack sensation, those hot sauce purveyors could shop for an up-and-coming certification regime that would guarantee the integrity of their product. This struck me as serious, worthy of investigation, and so I filed Kevin Kelly away as distraction and instead poured myself into these vendors of integrity, trying to get to the bottom of who they were and what exactly they were selling. Vendors of integrity. In many ways, the privatization of ethics makes perfect sense. Government regulation of our food is as spotty as a 14-year-old boy's first beard. It has grown out of federal agencies with conflicting and conflicted mandates and is driven by the political qualities of food and the political contributions of lobbyists rather than, say, a public-minded quest for fairness or consistency. There are areas where it's quite strong, even overly aggressive, and then whole wide patches where nary a regulatory hair has sprouted. To give some small context as to the relative gaps at play here, in 2009, the Government Accountability Office estimated that only 0.001% of all imported food products were inspected for fraud or mislabeling. A stat that sounds pretty damning on its own, but especially when juxtaposed with the fact that 50% of all fresh fruits and 80% of all seafood are in fact imported, and that when a voluntary fee-for-service seafood inspection program run by the Department of Commerce actually looked, it found fraud in 40% of the products submitted to it. Nor is domestically produced food much better off. A whopping 4.5% of domestic food production facilities are inspected by government regulators each year. Better than imports, yes, but when 0.001% is your bar, maybe stepping over it isn't quite the level of accountability we have in mind. In response to this general failure of government regulation, pretty much the most American thing imaginable happened. Lawyers, armed with sickening pictures of toddler food safety deaths, rushed in to fill the void. Starting with a 1993 Jack-in-the-Box E. coli outbreak, tort attorneys have reliably brought class-action lawsuits down upon the head of any food manufacturer even remotely responsible for a food safety violation. And the verdicts they have achieved, routinely in the millions of dollars, often in the tens of millions, forced manufacturers to implement reforms that weak government inspection simply did not. Bill Marler, the biggest, strongest, and savviest of these tort crusaders, estimates that he alone has won more than $600 million in food safety judgments. That's a $600 million incentive to clean up your act, spoken in a language the food industry actually understands. Timothy Litton, a professor studying quality assurance, tells me, forget the Food and Drug Administration. Right now, many would say Bill Marler is the de facto czar of food safety in America, and trial lawyers like him perhaps the most powerful guarantors of our health. But as is so often the case, the means dictate the ends. And grocery buyers quickly realized that if the regulatory threat was a lawsuit, what they needed most was a way to limit liability. And so, following the great food safety outbreaks of the 1990s, in particular 1993's Jack-in-the-Box E. coli, 1994's Schwann's Ice Cream Salmonella, 1996's Odwalla's Tainted Juice, buyers began tucking two new demands into their contracts. First, they required that companies submit to audits of their manufacturing process. These were in-plant walkthroughs by an outside observer. Second, they demanded that food manufacturers pay for these audits out of their own pockets as a part of the cost of doing business. These demands occurred at the very moment that we as a culture began plumbing the depths of our supply chains globally. Beyond Odwalla's E. coli-laden juice, 1996 was also the year The Gap would be attacked for its labor practices. Life magazine would publish a photo essay of a Pakistani boy stitching Nike soccer balls for 6 cents an hour, and Kathy Lee Gifford would bawl the mascara right out of her eyelashes on national TV, half an attack, half an apologia for her connection to Honduran sweatshops. Kathy Lee in particular, with her chirpy evangelical bearings and sticky sweet intentions, stood for a certain American naivete. We could mock her for being slow, insulated, and out of touch from realities most of us had only discovered a few short years earlier. At the height of her crisis, during a special pre-taped primetime segment, Kathy Lee proudly declared she would be paying for third-party inspections at every factory stitching her name in their product. There was nothing particularly new here, just the gradual mission creep of the food safety audit. But in the late 1990s, with the rise of corporate PR needing solutions converging with the rise of empowered consumers needing absolution, the social audit was an idea whose time had come. And so, from the dust of an anxious sanctimony, a mighty industry rose. In 1996, famed financial auditing firm Pricewaterhouse conducted exactly zero supply chain audits. By 1998, they were conducting 6,000 different types. By 2020, PricewaterhouseCoopers food audits are but a multi-million dollar drop in the $50 billion per year bucket that is the for-profit auditing industry. There are now thousands of firms conducting hundreds of thousands of audits across every sphere of production. Everyone from the Smithsonian Migratory Bird Center to certified paleo by the Paleo Foundation, certifying food just the way the caveman did it, has gotten into the act with a set of standards, a high design label, and a team of auditors willing to testify that a product meets their approval. As of this writing, the private auditing industry is about 10 times larger than every form of federal inspection combined, and it is growing each year. And like any growing industry, there's intense price competition, with each new auditing firm trying to corner the market by offering the cheapest, most efficient, least painful, and yet most noble, comprehensive, effective, reliable audit service out there. Mildly untrained, mildly invasive. Let me say this up front. Auditing is tough. First, you need to be an expert in your field to have any business doing it. Then you need to be the type of restless expert, willing to travel constantly from facility to facility, living out of hotels, heading to the desolate exurban spits around the globe where our factories and farms have been relocated, arriving at 5 p.m. one day, only to leave by 9 a.m. 40 hours later. The work itself is hard. Since there's never enough time for a really thorough inspection, everyone compensates by cramming everything into one, maybe two, really horrendously long days. The factories are often gargantuan. The five main export facilities for seafood processor Thai Union house a total of 45,000 workers. And regardless of hours or expense, it is physically and emotionally taxing work. Walking around the machines or fecal lagoons, poking your clipboard into everyone's business, your job and professional demeanor viewed not exactly as the bad guy, but as the guy who's affable and tells jokes to put people at ease, but ha 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 ha, might have to shut down a production line at the cost of several million dollars if there's an area of disagreement. Suffice to say, it's not easy finding a good auditor. And so, when the auditing industry exploded, it became necessary to focus more on the restless, willing-to-travel quality and less on the highly trained and expert one. Or it became easy to justify asking that true expert in poultry food safety to maybe consider cashing the check and conducting an audit on dairy cattle sanitation or the washing stages of lettuce, since they were, in fact, true experts at something that must be somewhat transferable, right? And of course, expertise being a humbling thing to achieve, these auditors were likely to know exactly how much they didn't know about lettuce wash cycles, and thus subtly defer to the undeniable experts who are running the plants or farms in question when they notice something borderline or suspicious. Footnote. It's almost insultingly obvious to say, but the skills needed to evaluate the pathogen wash cycle of a harvest are very different from those needed to verify the animal welfare of chickens in a shed, or whether the permeability of a material used in the co-packer's walls are acceptable for allergen containment. Expecting an auditor to toggle between the highly technical domains of modern agriculture, modern manufacturing, and modern labor practices is no more intelligible than asking a top soccer referee to judge a cricket match before sitting down to mediate a divorce settlement. You might think this expertise problem would be limited to the bottom rungs, but you'd be wrong. Top standards organizations are issuing certifications in food safety, food quality, and environmental responsibility, but according to food scientist Richard Steyer, the auditors who certified them were experts in car batteries and electric light bulbs. End footnote. Similarly, it became useful to hire independent contractors rather than nurturing long-term employees, thus pushing the question of auditor quality to another day. All of which combine to ensure that whenever the boom subsides, the standard of the mildly inexperienced, mildly untrained, mildly invasive auditor will have become the norm in the industry rather than a temporary thing. And yet, in terms of food safety, there's a lot to suggest this hybrid system of weak government regulation, strong tort hatchet work, and private auditing to fill the gaps has produced positive results. Our food is safer than it used to be. In 1999, there were sizable recalls of meat occurring on a monthly basis. 500,000 pounds, a million pounds. They don't happen anymore, Bill Marler tells me. I just don't get E. coli cases linked to hamburger. Something has changed. But ethical claims around labor, or say fraud against the USDA organic label, don't fit into the framework in the same way. For one, they don't produce sickening pictures of toddler food safety deaths. Nor do they produce a crop of grieving middle-class parents with the money and media platform to see a long lawsuit through to the end. Ethical audits also involve non-observable qualities that don't allow for sampling very easily. You could take a thermometer reading at a critical control checkpoint. It's much harder to determine whether a manager selectively withholds wages until his employees agree to work overtime. It's harder still 6 months after the fact during a one-time visit. These audits rarely occur unannounced, instead unfolding with all the spontaneity of a doctor's appointment. A date is set. Inspection questions previewed. When the auditors arrive, they're not true investigators. They cannot open locked doors. They cannot demand employee interviews, nor conduct them in neutral spaces. They cannot prevent retribution on employees who choose to speak out. They are guests of the facility and never left unsupervised. Retail brands often give auditing firms strict instructions about how deep into the supply chain to look. For instance, a labor auditor might focus on the payments a chocolate manufacturer makes to the farmers who supply it with beans. But the same manufacturer might insist that the auditor stop short of inspecting the farms themselves. Whether the workers there, the ones who are actually hand-harvesting the chocolate pods as detailed on the label, are getting paid, is never even considered. But even if they aren't hampered by the brands who require them or the suppliers who are paying for them, it's still unlikely auditors could produce much systemic change. That is simply not their purpose. Auditors cannot launch prosecutions against legal violations they uncover, nor impose direct penalties. In fact, if true call the police violations are happening at your business, an auditor is basically the friendliest set of eyes you can get. They might uncover some terrible things, but they're duty-bound to tell only you. So only you can decide whether to correct them. Finally, for the most desperate, the most clumsy, or the smallest, most vulnerable family-run facilities, there's overt fraud. Factory managers in China can buy software that allows them to keep multiple sets of records, attend trainings on how to falsify their books, or buy guidebooks teaching the best way to conceal a show factory, or simply issue a bribe. Li Qiang, founder of China Labor Watch, explains to the New York Times, "If a factory has 500 workers, to improve standards, you might need to pay each worker another $20 a month. But 500 workers at $20 is $120,000 a year. It's much cheaper to bribe auditors." My guess is overt fraud will always be a secondary or tertiary option. Who needs it when you have the tacit fraud of just shopping for auditors who will give you the results you want? It's baked into the private audit system. Or as one former auditor told me point blank, people don't hire you to blow up their deals. Which brings us back to Kevin. The more I learned, the less sense it made. I had millions of obvious questions. Given these problems, how exactly were social audits used? How did grocery stores, so sophisticated about managing risks with shipping logistics, evaluate the risks around food quality and fraud? How did they determine if these audits were accurate at all? Questions that, for equally obvious reasons, nobody in the grocery industry wanted to answer. When I asked Professor Tim Litton, who'd been studying these issues from an academic context, how to get more nuance about social audits, he essentially told me, good luck. He explained that my best shot at any practical insight was to, quote, become best friends with a supermarket quality assurance officer and maybe get drunk with them so that in the process they might divulge all their secrets. This is not the advice you hope for when talking to an academic about their area of research. So I revamped my approach slightly. I decided I needed to get as close to the inside as possible. Essentially, I thought that since audits are so sketchy and hazy, and yet ethical claims are so important, I, neutral me, should try to act as an independent set of eyes. I could audit the auditors. If that strikes you as dubious to the point of deep stupidity, good for you. You're way ahead of me. First, I poked around the world of food safety, bouncing from expert to expert, visiting them at their laboratories, heading out with them to the field. I thought that because food safety was empirical in ways that ethical claims were not, and because food scientists are called in to handle crises and therefore see corporate food at its most vulnerable, these scientists might have interesting things to say. They did, but mostly to call audits totally hostile, not helpful to print names on background. First clutch non-attributable quote, "I wouldn't wipe my ass with a food audit." From them, I learned the standard critique of the audit industry is most definitely shared by those who investigate outbreaks, but that food safety as an industry is in a slightly awkward place to actually make that critique out loud. Then, a second clutch, non-attributable remark. You want to talk about fraud? I've been to poultry sheds with 25,000 chickens with a little door at the back that no chicken ever sticks his head out of. Some of those chickens are sold for three times as much money because they're, quote, pasture-raised, and the rest are sold as conventional. Tell me, how's that not fraud? Leads me to ask for suggestions about how I verify that claim. This sends me to Fayetteville, Arkansas, where I attend a four-day avian influenza training for USDA veterinarians and scientists. The training is ostensibly to arm the agency with enough information and practical experience to respond on the ground should another epidemic strike, but that necessarily also includes a sweeping overview of the entire American poultry industry as context, featuring lecture after lecture from poultry industry insiders at a depth and nuance that doesn't patronize the veterinarians and scientists, and thus is a goldmine of insider details for yours truly. Third clutch aside, over the 35 days it takes to grow a chicken to maturity, the floor of the shed will rise 6 inches in height simply from the accumulated chicken shit the birds produce. And this chicken shit gives off ammonia gas so strong that the live catch handlers who go in to gather the chickens for slaughter have to apply cornstarch to their skin to prevent the ammonia from peeling the flesh off their bodies. Even more helpful, I get to talk with the various chicken farmers who attend and watch slide after slide in aforementioned sweeping overview of their industry with them, marveling at what can only be described as really impeccably clean poultry facilities, completely contrasting with the image blasted in my brain by animal rights activists. When I asked the chicken farmers, who don't know that I'm writing a book and don't have any discernible reason to lie since they've already gossiped about all sorts of other weird things to me during our mid-morning coffee breaks, whether the slides look accurate or not, they tell me they do. Except for the ammonia smell, which can't, of course, be captured in slide anyway. When I bring up the animal rights videos we've all seen, they don't deny them, but say, look, we make our money on percent livability, which usually needs to be right up around 95 if we're going to make a decent profit. The last thing we want are birds dying or kept in unhygienic conditions so they get sick. Also, they add, there's sickos all over the place. You used to be a public school teacher. How would you like it if we assumed you were a pedophile just because we've seen news reports about that? So I emerge from the experience quite turned around. These are USDA videos and slides, which are basically co-produced by Tyson Foods, the very definition of propaganda. And yet, I really don't think those vets and chicken farmers have any reason to lie to me. And so, after making a few discreet phone calls, I leave almost directly from the USDA training course to visit with a radical vegan animal rights group in California that breaks into confined animal facilities, liberates wounded animals, and promises to take me inside. Our first trip is to a swine farm. Footnote. Note on timeline and accuracy. I eventually go on two trips with the group, first to a swine farm, then to a caged egg facility. In addition, the group was generous and credible enough to allow me to view reams of unedited footage from their visits to other feedlots, chicken sheds, and egg facilities that do not inform my descriptions in the text, but do inform my general feeling of being overwhelmed by the complexity of the topic. End footnote. We arrive at 4 a.m., the smell of pig shit and pig meal coming in hard from the mile away that we park. After creeping in closer and scoping everything out, we slide into light blue Tyvek anti-contamination suits, wrapping our footwear in soft, sterile booties, lest we track in some disease and kill the whole shed in the name of saving it. It is procedurally exactly like my USDA training. The only difference is that it's pitch blackout and we're wearing headlamps. From here, I'm not sure what to say. Pigs have intelligent eyes. There's no other way to put it. And walking through this concrete barn, dust kicking up in the red beam of our headlamps, the light is caught by those tens of thousands of pig eyes. They glitter like holy orbs in the dark. And our slow walk through, listening to the pulsing lowing, the scared stomping at our intrusion, is deeply moving, dreamlike, and disturbing at the very same time. A sad communion with all these creatures we as a culture are going to eat. And yet, it is also exactly what I would expect. Yes, there are a number of grotesque tumors growing on certain pigs. Yes, there are a few open sores on others, exactly the hellscape features I've seen in videos. But the vast majority seem healthy. It is also 100,000 pigs we're wading through. I simply have no frame of reference. I wonder how many tumors and wounds we would see among the humans on the subway if we're all forced to ride naked. There are pigs crowded together, but to my eye, that looks like it happened because we woke them from their slumber and they are cowering together in fear. I remember vividly, and perhaps always will, a very happy young pig, or he looked happy to me, his pig snout in sort of a grin, and his eyes delighted with us as we passed, the rest of his face covered in giant pustulating warts. What do you make of even this one individual pig, much less an industry with hundreds of millions of others? Which is to say, visiting the facility gave me exactly zero answers. The volume of cruelty in any factory farm is so majestic that it echoes the larger human place in the world. You can be deafened by the noise of it or close your ears completely. My subsequent trip to the egg house was no different. I saw terrible, weird things. Footnote. Eggs with shells soft as jello from a calcium deficiency so that when you touch them, they quiver. Air choking with particulate matter, panicked birds. Again, most probably panicked at our presence, shrieking and clustering in terror. Escaped birds marauding around the floor, birds with huge clumps of missing feathers. End footnote. But I left just as I entered, capable at moments of seeing it like the USDA slides and capable of seeing it like the vegans. It was not filthy, nor a hellscape. It was instead an intensely alien, highly functional place for animals to live a sad, short life before they were set to die. As a group, we left the swine yard that night in silence, everyone in their own separate mental space driving back in meditation toward Los Angeles. All the vegans end up falling asleep, including the one at the wheel. So without any discussion or protest, I retrieve my cell phone, which had been confiscated by the group, and drive the sleepy radicals to our drop site, a fantastically lavish mansion in the hills. Then we all strip out of our clothes, clothes I think are probably permanently stained by the trauma of the smells they've been subjected to, and pass out in various states of dress and undress as the sun rises. As I'm falling asleep, in a miracle of double booking, I check my phone and see Kevin Kelly has responded to a last-minute inquiry. He's down for an interview, and so I'll see him tomorrow, that is today, at Le Pain Quotidien on Melrose Avenue. And so, caked in the odor of pig shit made physical on my skin, I meet Kevin in West Hollywood for lunch. Eyes buzzing with exhaustion, skin still impregnated by the previous night's odor, I stumble into Le Pain Quotidien. Kevin is there, waiting for me in a soft blazer. Unlike the minister on stage exhorting everyone to activate, the Kevin before me today has a dolorous face like a weary pooch, friendly, soft, and slightly worn. Truly, I haven't prepared for this interview. I wasn't entirely expecting it. I'm disoriented from sleep deprivation, and while I try to get my bearings, I ask him about business. I expect he has a pre-baked promotional spiel he can launch into. Instead, he just shakes his head sadly. "It's like an alcoholic calling," he says. "These stores have nowhere to turn, and so they call me. This is a dying business, and nobody knows what hit them." I'm aware of the current retail apocalypse, but it isn't new, nor what I came for. I want Kevin to talk about retail architecture, about marrying interior design with psychology, about creating bliss points that facilitate the consumer and create joy. "They all want to play the quantification game," he continues. "Well, guess what? You aren't going to out-quantify Amazon. And if you think you can run a lumberyard of food that's going to beat Walmart, you're crazy." "Right," I say, trying to steer our conversation back on track. "So you help them take that lumberyard and add in bliss points? Kind of rearrange the design so people want to buy?" "Bliss points," he says. "Yeah, we can talk bliss points if you want." And he looks almost bored. "But these guys don't need that. When I get one of them on the phone and they ask about bliss points, I say, 'What do you devote your life to?'" I'm not sure where this is going. These are retailers who've sucked the soul out of their business. Now they're like an alcoholic calling me for one more drink. He pauses. "You're writing about an American tragedy. But it's not the tragedy you think. It's a tragedy of imagination. We have a generation of guys that can only imagine being Walmart." And then he breaks off. Maybe he thinks he's losing me. Maybe he is. "Okay," Kevin says, "but you want to hear about bliss points." And at this, as if pulling a scrim from the world, he introduces me to the Pain Quotidien we're sitting in all over again. To begin, it's a Belgian country store. Not French, Belgian. Kevin maintains this is a very specific difference, evoked in all sorts of details, from the softer color of the wood to the style of fixtures on the white cabinet behind us. It doesn't matter that I don't know the difference between a French or a Belgian country store. What matters is that somebody did. That it was a real and deliberate decision, and that person imbued the space with a cohesion. But that cohesion is only a starting point. Kevin describes the next phase as realm building, and it requires taking those ideas and crafting an experience. Every stage of your interaction is part of a narrative, he tells me. Your experience started outside, from the view of the building. There was a picket fence, a porch. Maybe you consciously registered these things, but likely not. Then, as you move in, he continues, there are some big symbols to slam you over the head. This giant table, he points to the huge communal table that I never realized defines every Pain Quotidien. Maybe no one even wants to sit at it. That doesn't really matter. It's a symbol. It says something about this scene. A scene like a movie, I ask? Exactly. That's the standard we're trying to hit. I want retail that can reorient your emotions in the same way that a movie can. Isn't that manipulative, I ask? Let me turn that around, he says. Are movies manipulative? Is art? And the answer is, of course, retail should be no different. It should move us emotionally, but to expand us. The real problem is nobody thinks about retail in those terms because there are a lot of bozos who only care about money. And here he stops. See, you were thinking bliss points, but bliss points don't exist on their own. They exist because a consumer taps into something meaningful. Think for a minute. What do you tap into when you buy? What matters to you, and why? Buying into meaning. At the grocery store, we not only buy food to taste, but also to demonstrate taste, which is to say our discernment. And in this way, it's like all American consumption, deeply attached to our sense of self. We buy things to stake claims, to demonstrate autonomy, to assert our unique experience, Sociologist Colin Campbell traces this ethic back to the Romantic poets, who glorified self-discovery, instructing the writer to express what he thinks and feels, and to reveal the depths of the human soul. And our tastes do just that. We express them. They reveal us. Back in the grocery store, this gets delightfully complicated, because taste also exists in a third dimension, the socially determined one. That is to say, in addition to the buds in our mouth and our outwardly exhibited discernment, we can speak about what makes someone have good versus bad taste, which has nothing to do with individual expressing their depths, but exists insofar as their expression matches a social judgment. Anthropologist Daniel Miller studied purchasing decisions of Britons and Trinidadians and came to the conclusion that most people didn't even know whether they liked something until after they shared it with others. I started with the assumption it was going to be a study of people wanting something, buying it, and then discovering themselves in it, he says. That was not it at all. People hesitantly ended up buying things, and it wasn't until they had a response from others that they decided whether they liked it. And if we personalize this dynamic, the holy grail of American taste seems to be the type of person whose individual taste is both an expression of them as an individual and one that is socially approved, two ideas that are by definition in tension, and thus taste and consumption itself is bound up in a paradox of sorts, freedom to express the unique self, but requiring approval from the greater conforming community, which itself is tied up in an even greater paradox. We believe we're individuals with an essence that does not depend on material objects. But if that essence or sense of individuality is ever going to mean anything, if it's ever going to be demonstrated to our social group, then possessions and material objects are one of the few effective means of showcasing it. It all works together to make our relationship to material goods very tricky. Cultural theorist Grant McCracken grappled with a lot of these tensions and found that when you really got down to it, consumer goods carry meaning in a very particular way. He believed that as people, we take our highest ideals, our most precious selves, and valuable understandings, and remove them from daily reality. This removal is primarily self-protective. On some level, we understand they can't live up to the assault of real life. They are ideals, after all. But they mean so much to us that we want to preserve them. And to preserve them, we place them in a different space or time, perhaps in a golden age when things were better, or perhaps in heroes like George Washington or Beethoven, whom we'll never know personally and thus are less likely to fail us. He called these displaced ideals, and his central idea was that we use material possessions to provide a bridge back to them. Once I start looking, I see this everywhere. My city slicker aunt's collection of cowboy boots, a wealthy friend's pride in his $1.99 tube socks, my winter jacket, designed for a Himalayan ascent, yet destined for snowy walks in Brooklyn. But perhaps nowhere do I see it more than in the grocery store. In the supplement aisle, of course, all those herbal, Ayurvedic, neurotropic signifiers we grab at and swallow, but also in the food itself. The entire Michael Pollan ethos is, after all, a way of making food a bridge to the past when the world was simple and purer. And of course, there are those certifications and seals. Somewhere between the time I was in elementary school scampering up and down the aisles of our local supermarket, begging my mother to buy Salisbury steak frozen dinners, and a college freshman packing 99-cent cans of black beans in my cart, something shifted. I remember the first sushi restaurant in my neighborhood. Then I remember the first time little cartons of sushi appeared next to the Gatorade at checkout. Then the Gatorade went organic. Where once Julia Child helmed a single low-budget live-to-videotape television show on French cooking, suddenly there was an entire media empire. Food got its own television channel, or actually two, Food Network and The Cooking Channel, not to mention 60-plus national-level magazines supplying content to compete with around 21,000 food-centric blogs. Growing up, food had just been food. To use it as a tool for self-definition would have been deranged, but that was then. This is now. For many of us, this shift represented something of a discovery. Food became the perfect stage to resolve all our tensions around consumption. It is, after all, a material good in the good old-fashioned purchase, flaunt, and self-express sense. And yet, as you chop, fry, and chew it, food becomes entirely experiential. Then it is gone. And we are forced to do it all over again for the next meal. Where historically, food signified a few narrow ideals, primarily around wealth and social standing, now it went impossibly wide, offering a blitz of expressive possibilities, from our relationship to our bodies, to our relationship with the natural world, to every aspirational desire in between. Thin, muscular, compassionate, worldly, closer to our ancestors, unique from our kin, food allowed us to advertise who we wanted to be, who we desperately believed we were, all while simply meeting our vital needs, sideslipping those larger consumptive clichés. It was, in short, the perfect blank space for displaced ideals. The dark side of this aspect of consumption, McCracken writes, is it helps enlarge our consumer appetites so we can never reach a sufficiency of goods and declare, I have enough. And so it is with food. Once we discovered this genie, we were in its thrall, and the grocery store was only too happy to supply bottle after bottle for us to consider, compare, and decide whether it was the one our true self might pop out of. Retail is a giant reflection of society, what people are thinking and wanting and looking for, Kevin tells me when we meet back up a few months later in Los Angeles. Fundamentally, I think we are a meaning-seeking species, and I think we place a lot of meaning in consumption. When I watch Kevin work with his grocery clients, those entrepreneurial alcoholics who've come a-calling, I see this search for meaning directly. What I find most surprising is that it's not unidirectional, not simply about targeting shoppers or getting people to buy more, but about building something meaningful on both sides, creating an exchange where everyone involved can feel proud. Up close, it's almost wholesome to watch. These big, chunky grocery guys huddled around a corporate conference table, Kevin's soft eyes like a crowbar on their souls. One says, "We couldn't have run a drier, more impersonal store if we tried." Another, "I just want to build a store I don't have to apologize for." This interpersonal work, reconnecting to a sense of purpose, then unfolds into soul-searching in a more literal survey sense. Kevin takes inventory of their brand and looks for anything resembling a soul there. Sometimes this is easy. At one meeting, the management team from a grocery chain in Alberta, Canada, comes down to his LA offices. The founder, in his 90s, attends at Kevin's request. As the team discusses the stores, Kevin pulls the founder in at every decision point, squeezing his personality back into the chain. "At lunch, they started making fun of our sandwiches. They were too small and dainty," Kevin tells me, and I turn to him and said, "Okay, what do you like?" He says, "I like sandwiches so juicy the bread is soggy, and you have to wipe your chin because the gravy is dripping on your face." Kevin seizes on this. It's odd and real, and just what he's looking for. At a different meeting, one of the younger Albertan owners describes his home routine and says, "I like to make sauerkraut in the root cellar." And bam, in unison, Kevin's entire team puts pen to paper, scribbling, "Root cellar. That's powerful," Kevin responds. Minutes later, another manager describes his bread-making process and lets slip the phrase, "mother dough." And the designer next to me, a woman in a full-length wool dress that looks like it costs slightly more than my monthly rent, lets out a gasp. Mother dough. Kevin collects all these insights and anomalies, the sopping sandwiches, the root cellars, the bread that relies on a phrase so incantatory and out of time it couldn't possibly be made in a factory, connecting them like crumbs or clues, and uses them to build a realm. His team keeps giant evidence boxes of items they find during this exploratory phase, and sifting through one, you'll see everything from internal stationery to pages from the annual report to employee ID badges. "It all feeds the beginning of a story," he says. "Once we have that story, we take it and make it physical. It will be a realm honoring the Alberta that the owners have introduced him to, and that will lead to a store that is more real to them, that isn't competing with Walmart." Other times, the process is hard. There are no founders, or the founders have been bought out and ignored, or the current employees have become fixated on price alone. "The maddest I've ever gotten was with a manager at a health food chain," Kevin tells me. "The guy asked me, will doing this help me sell more shit to more people?" Which is just ignorant, just strip mining their larger purpose. In these cases, Kevin has to work harder to find that meaningful exchange. Instead of beginning with store leadership, he listens to the people they aspire to serve. Then he summons up his inner salesman and sells their vision back to the higher-ups. I watched this process with another grocery chain, a popular brand in California, recently bought by a private equity group. Here, Kevin's team, a collection of cultural anthropologists, interior designers, and visual artists, hits the parking lot. "We just followed customers out the door," he explains, "saw the cars they were driving, then saw the houses they drove to, then asked a lot of really open-ended questions. From there, Kevin goes on the same fact-finding detective hunt he used with the Albertans. Take one interview. We called him Mythological James because we wanted to study him like an archetype. The real James was 33 years old. He leased a Porsche, then downgraded to a Lexus. He comes from a wealthy LA family. And when we interviewed him about the store, he said, "I shop there because it's an expensive Ralph's," which is the type of cryptic statement that makes Kevin's curiosity drool. What does it mean? What are the needs behind this desire to shop at an expensive Ralph's? Why wouldn't you just go to Ralph's itself, a competing supermarket literally down the block? And so the study of James unfolds until, like all myths, it begins to speak to something larger. James self-describes as tasteful and classy. But if you look at what he actually craves, it's lasagna and red wine. Quinoa is an adventure, and he doesn't want adventurous food, Kevin explains. But he also doesn't want simple. Simple is a trap. Thinking of him as a boob is a trap. He wants the classics upgraded and reinvented. And then there's a cross current of modesty in James. He's actually quite health conscious, but he doesn't have the vanity for Lululemon, prefers jogging to yoga. We kept arguing about all this. My team kept saying, "He's California classic." But what does that mean? James isn't eating Alice Waters. He's a Wolfgang Puck frozen pizza man. Eventually, the clues coalesce and a realm begins to emerge, just as it did with Alberta or Le Pan Quotidien. Here, an unpretentious Mediterranean California. And whether you love or hate James and his realm, it is a place where unconsciously he will feel at home. Or as Kevin says, it might look tacky to you, but that's because it's not for you. The more I hang around with Kevin Kelly and scratch almost any consumeristic itch, the more it bleeds pathos. At one point, Kevin talks about his work for Harley Davidson, which hired him to help understand a prolonged sales slump. It is not grocery, but just like the search to understand James, Kevin began to haunt Harley dealerships. Soon, he was going to hog meetings. The whole scene was very strange at first. He'd meet big, angry, swaggering Harley customers who were also terrified of riding their bikes out of their cul-de-sacs in their suburban developments. I remember one of my first insights, Kevin tells me. I had a long conversation at a meeting. An angry man, wealthy, but hard scrubbed. He tells me what I came to call a Harley story, like a Vietnam vet story, but about his bike. And instead of a punchline or a joke at the end, he leans in and gives me a hug. Kevin was astonished. Just as with James and his expensive Ralphs, the hug made no sense. But as he turned the moment over with his team, Kevin watched the anomaly turn into insight. It's obvious now, but these are men that aren't comfortable with their emotions, he explains. And that means they can't read emotions, which means they don't know when they're validated by other men. Back around a table on Melrose, his team realized one of the few things that did validate these men was danger. Or rather, the image of danger that was a Harley. And so Kevin and his team began to pour themselves into rituals of man-making, looking everywhere from the martial arts to pre-contact Amazonia, trying to connect their findings to the rituals in the Harley community. Once we knew what we were looking for, we found man-making rituals everywhere. But new riders were terrified of them, Kevin says. We discovered that if we could make those rituals a little easier, we could build the community these guys wanted so badly. From here, the team got tangible and prototyped a series of Harley bars, carefully constructed to take a slight edge off the unspoken initiation rituals, while still allowing the men to confront symbols of danger. Places where a wannabe rider could come, drink a beer, and for a moment experience what it might feel like to belong. Which is what Kevin made me see. It's easy for me to nod along as Kevin talks about those Harley riders. They are safe and distant, and as a nice young new age man who can express his emotions like a sneeze, I can barely recognize them. But what about my own anomalies? What activates me? Then it hits me one day as I'm thinking about audits. I want to use purchases to create a better world. I take it as almost a given, this belief that through shopping, I can somehow contribute to the general uplift of mankind. But what type of sense does that make? Buying something for myself to serve others? The more I reflected, the more I saw a self-serving riddle, as contradictory as any Harley hug, as cryptic as any expensive Ralph's. And if I mythologize my weird belief, like Kevin did to James, apply the same compassion and introspection he gives those Harley riders, I begin to see a greater meaning behind it. In America today, our dependencies are multitude. Every single product we buy, every piece of food we eat, it all comes from someplace else. 1,000 different fingers contributing to a few afternoon snacks. In another universe, that dependency could be reframed as connection, a mutualistic web or ecosystem. But here, now, for me, there's a deep powerlessness. All these systems, from the political to the economic, that we were born into, that we have not chosen, that we would not recreate, yet that operate on our behalf. What I craved was a reassurance that the glut of pleasure and variety, from the 99-cent bag of chips to the heaps of grass-fed ground lamb, weren't an unfair bounty, but an opportunity. That my passivity could actually be flipped into a chance to take action, validate myself. That despite all my taking, I could give back. Which is, of course, precisely what those ethical, organic, and fair labor seals are offering. Talking to Kevin about bliss points, I begin to understand. Third-party certification does not exist to solve a problem in the world, but to solve one inside of me. Their primary purpose is not to make the world a better place. It's to make the grocery store a safer place for me to shop. They lower my barriers to buy by promising me two things I crave, a sense of control and a sense of destiny. In reality, audits are faulty, easily gamed, expensive, cumbersome, and antithetical to creating trusting mutualistic relationships. They are terrible at enforcement. Rather than connect me to others, audits align incentives in a closed loop between manufacturers who pay a small fee to get graded on a soft curve, grocers who don't have to worry about rising prices from true reform, and customers who get the same variety and convenience, plus a sense of virtue for only a few extra pennies. We all win, except those outside the circle, which is why you're never meant to examine third-party audits at all. The preferred level of scrutiny is a half glance at a tiny label on the shelf, like all displaced ideals, kept at a distance in order to be preserved. It's easy to talk about the tricks and traps of market capitalism, the ways we're being manipulated, but I needed Kevin to show me how much any manipulation begins at home. And I've come to believe that to the extent the system consciously triggers these needs in me, it is to the extent it believes in them too. If anything, this is a conspiracy of good intentions, convincing ourselves in circles that we're doing just enough not to require any uncomfortable action, replacing the terror of a gargantuan world with a feeling of control. Tim Litton, the professor examining certification regimes, said something in our first conversation that took a while to sink in. "People talk a lot about trust in the grocery world," he said. "It is a tremendously good-natured industry. But on another level, people talk about trust because there's basically nothing else you can do. If you have 15,000 produce suppliers out there, there's no way to handle the volume of information coming in. You talk about trust, but what's really going on is flying without instruments." There's an aphorism attributed to the Buddhist monk Thich Nhat Hanh, "Our own life has to be our message," which I interpret to mean, while we may use material objects to reveal our depths, curate our clothing, meals, and pantry shelves to show each other who we imagine we are, there's a more primary method of self-expression, how we choose to live our lives, how we treat one another, how we demonstrate care. Retail is one of the oldest, most important forms of human connection, one circle outside of family, and just as important in current society to meeting our vital needs. Its uniquely material focus makes it a bridge between these two forms of self-expression, between the possessions we flaunt and how we treat the people who make them. Right now, the methods of bringing integrity to this connection, the signs and seals of certification, make no corresponding effort to span this divide. They promise us that moments of individual action can create a type of change that in reality only institutional forces like labor laws, unions, and trade deals can begin to approach. They allow us to purchase our ideals from others without ever having to enact them on our own. "Humans have a desire to connect," Kevin says during one of our last conversations. "The mistake in retail is forgetting we need to help the customer do that. How do we get them to participate? How do you get them to say, 'I can't just show up and buy. I need to act. I need to affect this story.'" He pauses. "These companies who think they're going to win on price, I mean, you can try. But you'll probably lose, and just to get the chance to lose, you will have to lower yourself." He concludes the thought with a statement he inflects more like a question. "I like to think most of us wouldn't want to win that contest, even if we could."